My name is Bill Daldeau, and this is the first of our conversations about the landmarks. The book Landmarks, Turning Points on Your Journey Toward God was released back in March, and the 9 landmarks described in the book form the journey that we all have to take if we want to live well and love well and follow Jesus in this life. It is the path of following him into his death and resurrection. The first 4 landmarks describe a descent into a death. The 5th is a turning point. And the last 4 describe a resurrection into real life with him. Joining me in these conversations will be men that have been really important in my life. They are taking a risk to come and just speak about their lives as it pertains to each of the landmarks. Daniel will be joining me for each of these conversations. And I wanted Daniel to be here for each one because he was actually the first person to hear about the landmarks. And so I thought it was really appropriate for him to come and play that part. Daniel is a counselor and a good friend of mine. Daniel, it's great to have you here.
It's good to be here, Bill.
And then along with Daniel, each time will be a different man that will join in the conversations. And for this first landmark, I've asked Carter, another one of my close friends, to join us. And Carter, it's good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
That's great. Well, let's go ahead and get started with the first landmark. And it's simply called Story. What do I mean by landmark number 1 is story? Well, the Bible presents God as authoring a grand story of creation and then of redemption. But along the way, we all disconnect from that story and start to write our own fallen stories. And I want to just quote briefly here from the book itself. All of us to one degree or another disconnect from God's story because we are fundamentally committed to being the author of our own stories. Actually, we attempt to do something even more grandiose and irrational. We not only author our own story, but we try to direct it, produce it, and play the lead role. We justify this as perfectly acceptable because we think we know what's best for us, which for all of us is finding happiness and avoiding pain. And that's where we want our conversations to begin, because we need to figure out what our fallen stories really are and how in the world are we going to take those fallen stories and get back up into the grand story that God is writing. So let's start with some storytelling about our lives, Daniel and Carter. Every good story has key themes in it, and our lives are no different. There are certain themes, core beliefs in the stories that run our lives, and these themes usually get formed unconsciously from our own experiences of pain, shame, and loss. So let's talk about some of those themes in our lives and the experiences that form them. So who wants to jump in?
Well, I will.
Thanks, Carter.
You know, as I think about this, first, one of the things I've enjoyed about the landmarks is I feel like that it has helped me put words to what you just said about the things that happened to me that were unconscious, that I was not really aware of. But my story is, I think, fairly typical. And I was born in Alabama and raised in a home with 2 parents. A defining moment for me coming up was the death of my father from an accident. And I only later realized, after he passed away, that my mother actually left too, emotionally.
Wow.
And so it really took me a while to begin to understand that I lost both parents at one time.
Yeah.
And that marked a real turning point for me, because I think what happened for me is, unconsciously, I knew I was alone, is really what it came down to. I was all alone.
You were on your own.
I was on my own. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And because I was on my own, I was the one responsible to make life work. And the choices I made to make life work actually ended up shattering my life.
Yeah, and that's usually the way it goes.
Oh, God, I tell you what. I'm like a textbook.
The textbook case right here.
I'm not kidding you. I am a textbook when it comes to that. But I, of course, while it was happening, I had no clue that's what was going on.
Yeah.
And so the choices I made to make life work basically involved using other people to find something that they couldn't possibly give me. Of course, I just lived under the illusion that I needed to run harder or, have more. But of course, I never really found what I was looking for.
Yeah, and what is it that they couldn't give you in terms of,
you know,
some words of that?
I think at the core, what I was looking for was to be loved.
Yeah.
I mean, just to be loved.
Yeah.
And it was just such a deep ache inside of me. I wanted to be loved, and I wanted somebody to...
Wow, that's such important language, Carter.
Nobody ever came.
And at the loss of your parents, and it's just like that abandonment, and it's like, somebody come for me. That's such important language.
And, you know, I want to say, I don't blame my mother, because she had her own wounds, hurts that she was dealing with. And so I don't have any bitterness or anything mm-hmm. like that, but it did sure help to understand that I was always looking for someone to come for me. And then when they didn't, I just ended up taking matters into my own hands.
Right.
So yeah. How old were you when your father died?
But my father passed away when I was 9.
Wow.
So, you know, junior high school and college, you know, when I was 24, I was married, and my wife married a 12-year-old in a 24-year-old body.
Yeah.
Because I stopped growing emotionally when I was, I had a momentum from 9 to, and I made it to 12 and stopped.
And then, right.
Exactly.
Right. And that's so much like my story.
My gosh.
You just, yeah, when you start hitting manhood, it's just like you don't have somebody to come for you. It's just like you're stuck.
So yeah. I was a little boy. Fortunately, God had mercy on me, and I married a woman who stuck with me in the transformational process that God ultimately brought me through.
Right.
And is bringing me through.
Right, still. Well, we're all in process.
Mm-hmm.
Let me add, because yours is so much like mine, let me throw out a story, too, from my own life and a theme that came from it. And this is one that when I speak about story, I usually talk about this story because it's so pivotal, and it's in some ways very much like yours, not in terms of death, but some of the things that came out of it. But I was a pretty carefree sort of boy, and nothing really major or tragic happened to me. And I was geeky. I was studied a lot in school. I had big glasses. I tell people I would be a poster child for, you know, a geek poster. And I really looked like that.
You
and
grew out of that, though.
I did grow
you
out
grew
of it.
Out of that, baby.
Your glasses have shrunk over the years.
Good. So glad. But it's not an image I want to keep necessarily. But I was 12, and the teacher said, you know, we're going to have a basketball tournament. It was the, you know, winter, and people are tired of school, and I was in the 7th grade, and it was a new school for me, and I was a little nervous about that, and I saw boys that got mocked by other boys, and just like I am, you know, it's like, you don't want to go there. You want to stay out of that. And so I sort of figured out those social boundaries to avoid all that, and the teacher just says, you know, we're going to have this basketball tournament between the homerooms, and so she called up my name as part of the team. And inside, I just went, what? I didn't know the first thing about basketball. I'd never been coached in it. I didn't even know what the rules were. And so I remember going to the basketball court with this, like, impending sense of doom, like a sort of an animal going to the slaughterhouse.
Oh,
it's just like, it's going to drop. You know, something's going to, bad's going to, and there's nothing I could do about it. And I got out on the court, and I just remember going, running up and down, and of course, when you're in that situation and you don't know what to do with the ball, when you get it, you just shove it off as quick as you can to somebody else who looks like they know what they're doing. And I can remember just feeling helpless and stupid out there, and this growing feeling that I'd never felt before, just coming all over me. And it was my first experience of shame and the potential mockery that could come from not being able to do something that it looked like every other boy knew how to do. And just something shifted that day. It was so deep, and so it just seemed so permanent. I never felt carefree again. I became self-protective, wary, watchful. I was always on my guard. And that story formed a pivot for so many years of my life, long into marriage, into being a minister, into being a teacher and a coach. And when I finally pulled up words to it, this was the theme of my story that was running me for years, and it was simply this: never, ever fail in front of other people. I will never go through this type of shaming experience again. And that theme was more important than anything, and more controlling than anything I ever heard from the Bible, or anything I ever really tried to do in my heart that I wanted to obey God. That seemed to be the unconscious thing I always had to obey, never fail in front of others, and, you know, eventually sort of just, you know, tore my life apart like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I was became perfectionistic, I was risk averse, I always wanted to present the right image in front of people, and, you know, all those sorts of things kind of came out of this. And I stopped growing as a man. I mean, if you can't risk failure, what are you going to do? I was 13 for years. I mean, my wife married a 13-year-old. Because mm-hmm. that's about when that basketball story happened mm-hmm. in the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. So very, very similar to kind of that. And that underlying theme also of just having to figure out life on my own.
Well, at least you were a teenager when you got married.
At least. So anyway, that's kind of you know, goodness. One of those pivotal stories that formed that theme that ran my fallen story for years. Daniel, what about you? Where would you like to go with this?
You know, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of similarities between my story and y'all's story, and in some ways, very different. I was born into a Christian family, two parents. I was the oldest. I had two younger sisters, and, you know, going to church at an early age. And there was, early on, a legitimate awareness of the supernatural and of God and a curiosity about God, and I think that was true and good. Side story, my parents, they had a lot of struggles in their relationship. And some of them I knew about, most of them I did not. But one of the results of that was a father who was fairly disconnected from my mother and from me and my siblings, and then a mother who was hungry for the relational input and involvement with a man. And I remember as a young man, a boy really, you know, 9-10 years old, feeling like my mother and I had a close relationship. I remember our next door neighbors, my mom and the mother at our neighbor's home would, I've got these distinct memories of just sitting around the kitchen table while my younger siblings and the children of my mother's friend were running around playing, and I would be at the table participating in just kind of conversation with these two older women when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And I remember something started to kind of click in my heart without my even knowing it, that one, that I connect with adults almost more easily than I do with other kids.
Wow.
And two, that I get a certain affirmation as a young boy trying to learn what it means to be a man by the attention of older people, and in this case, women. And something in me believed that I will be loved to the extent that I am deep and mature and relationally intuitive and powerful. And so
that's what you felt with them in the conversation.
Right. There's just this affirmation of I belong here.
I got
I think Carter, as you said, you don't blame your mother. I don't blame my mother for that because, you know, there's a sense in which that was healthy, but there's also a sense in which something in me started to believe that I have to be kind of there and strong all the time. Mm. And so I learned to kind of fake it until you make it, where I put this tremendous pressure on myself to always be wise and insightful, deep, serious. My relationships with women through high school, through college. I mean, women didn't know what to do with me because I was so deep and so grown up, in quotations. I wasn't really.
They just wanted to have some fun.
They just wanted to have a good time. And I'm, you know, asking them their, you know, their life stories and deepest, darkest secrets and all this. And, of course, then I went into counseling, which, you know, in some ways was great. In some ways,
it
feeds it. My own worst enemy, you know, where you're, again, affirmation.
Right.
For relationally being kind of always deep and strong. And it has served me and it's crippled me. Both, I've seen both at work.
Wow.
There's a sense in which I really am deep. I really am intentional. I really am strong.
And this may be part of your gifts, you know, from the Lord.
I believe it is. And it's so hard for me to admit weakness. And to allow others to be strong for me. to be intentional with me, to enter in with me, because I feel like I've always got it. The buck always stops with me.
Yeah.
My dad, you know, and that my mom, buck didn't stop with him, stopped with me. Girls I dated, my younger sisters, a lot of friendships. And it just over and over and over was affirmed by others of you're so, I remember my dad when I was maybe 10, kind of in awe of me saying, you're more mature at 10 than I was when I was 25. And I remember thinking that's a good thing.
Do you think some of this was like maybe part of the absence of your dad, or just that you had to be this way?
I think so. I don't think he was living out enough strength, certainly for my mother and even for my sisters and me, that would let me be 12 and not
just be the
22.
Boy. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I had friends in graduate school say, Daniel, you're the deepest person I've ever met. And I didn't know if it was a compliment or a backhanded smack in the face. And I honestly don't know if he knew either. It was a little, because I, you know.
Felt like I didn't know what to do with it.
Right. It can be irritating to a point.
And how did that affect the friendships that you had?
People that wanted... if you look at the a lot of the relationships I've had over the years, most of them are all fairly intense indeed. And I have learned to play, but to be honest, I'm still learning what it means to receive from God, receive from others, not have to be always deep, intense, the one who can handle everything. And I'm realizing it's been fear and also pride that has driven me to have to always be that person.
Yeah.
But Carter, when you talk about the people couldn't give you what you wanted, what you really wanted to be loved. See, I think I believed the way I'm loved, or at least noticed and appreciated, is for what I have to offer in terms of being deep and intense and relationally strong. And what that has done, I've noticed, especially recently, is I have grown resentful. Resentful when people need me. On the one hand, I've wanted to give, but there's this subtle, I find myself, why am I so irritated with people that I really do love, really do want to give to, but then when they need what I would have to offer them now, in my late 30s, when it's appropriate that I would, why is there something in me that's kind of irritated about that? And I think, you know, to use a cliche phrase, I'm mourning my lost childhood almost.
Right. It's like, I just want to be, can I just be a boy here?
Do you exactly.
Have to, do I have to come through for you again?
That's right.
Wow.
I get that. Yeah. Yeah. Part of the y'all's story, one of the things that I hear in the themes is, you know, and certainly in my case was this way, was, and this theme took me even longer to put words to, because it was the mold into which my heart was cast. It was just a sense about life. And you put words to it, Carter. It was like, I'm on my own to figure this out. And your language is, nobody's going to come for me. You know, and Daniel, you kind of alluded to that. It's sort of like, I have to sort of engineer this, and there's no sense of the love is freely coming anyway from the outside. It's like,
that's
I got to manufacture and figure out how to make this work.
If I don't hold it together, no one's going to love me.
That's right. Yeah.
And for me,
that's such pressure, you know, underneath that. Yeah.
The way that worked for me is I became whatever people needed me to be, whether they knew it or not. Whatever I felt like they needed so that they would really like me.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting, the word I used to describe the way I used to relate to people is parasitic. Mm. I was a parasite.
That's
latching
a strong word.
On.
That's
I'll
a
tell you what,
it,
but that's what I need to understand how I used to do relationship, which was not relationship at all. You know, parasites don't just have relationships.
Like
they just suck the life out of people. But as I came to grip with that's the way I thought relationship really was, you know, I was able to get really sad about it too, Dan. Mm. I appreciate the way you just said you're mourning that loss, because I've had a lot of loss there too.
Yeah,
and it's been helpful to mourn it, and then also rejoice in learning to relate in a great way.
Right, right. Yeah. And see that redemption.
Yeah, that. To see the redemption.
Wow. Let's, guys, this has been great just telling a bit of our story and trying to put words to some of those themes. And it's such an important thing for all of us to sort of do at these real fundamental levels in our own hearts. But the reason why we do this is we're trying to, you know, be freed from these core places of sin and disconnection from God, from His presence, from His beauty, from His power, from knowing Him and feeling that we are being known by Him. And so, but there's the catch is this, to begin to let God author our stories in the beautiful and wonderful way that He'll do with redemption, we have to let go of writing our own stories. And the scriptures talk about that, that the word is used repentance or submission to God,
surrender.
Mm-hmm. All of those are good language for that. And what I'd like to talk about just a bit is when you think about like this, giving up these core themes in your life and letting them go and saying, you know, God, I submit to whatever story you want to write for me. Like what rises up in your heart? You know, and they can be positive things or negative things or combination or mixture.
Well, I'll tell you for me, Bill, just a little bit about how that happened for me. First, it was extremely helpful for me to begin to realize that my deep desire for connection was legitimate. Mm-hmm. So at the very core, I had a legitimate desire.
That's a critical insight.
And so, yeah, because I realized, okay, I'm looking for something that I really do need. The train wreck comes when I go to the wrong places to try to find it.
Right.
And so in coming to grips with that longing for a deep, deep intimacy, something, and this was a God moment for me, something that happened for me was I realized that the choices I had made early on were choices to center life on myself, make it all about me, as you talk about, you know, me writing my own story. Okay, so I picked up the pen. What I began to realize is, you know, God has a part for me in the larger story He wants to write, but He has a part for me.
And
because
it's a good part.
It's a good part, and I'm significant
the best part.
To Him.
Yes.
You know, and that was really incredible. And so I began to see Jesus Christ as the way out of my smaller story and into His larger story. And so
I love the way you put that.
Well, and you know, He really showed that to me. And the way I began to understand biblical language like being born again and salvation and things like that was he really took my life that I'd centered on myself and began to center it around Him, thereby making me other-centered instead of parasitic. Which was the freedom I'd always been looking
it's
for.
It's a revolution.
No, it was, and it was so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Absolutely counterintuitive. So don't let me fool you. It felt like death.
Yeah. Well, and I want to say something about that, too. When you say counterintuitive, part of the things about our stories is because they're our stories, it's like the rain that carves out the river canyon, you know, that over time we get these ruts and we get so used to being and living and relating a certain
love
way.
Love that imagery.
You don't even know. Mm-hmm. And it's just your natural where when the water comes down, you get right back into there. Mm-hmm. And it literally takes God pulling you up and saying, look at this whole canyon you cannot see because you've been stuck down in this creek.
Mm-hmm.
And what seems like normal, legitimate, the way things are so often, almost in every life is not. So when you talk about counterintuitive, I resonate with that. I think, oh my word, the times that God has shown me what's bigger, the God story, that's not what I, doesn't fit the formulas that I've used in my own life.
Were there, Dan, were there particular disruptive things that showed you a new course?
Yes.
That's often how it happens.
Right.
We get disrupted. We get disrupted, and it's not pleasant.
Well, and there's a story I do want to tell. It one really disruptive story that was such a gift. I think Paul talks about the wounds of a friend are faithful. I had a friend when I was in graduate school in Colorado named Brad. And, you know, again, my background is feeling like I have to always be deep. And part of that is there can't be some weakness or lack in me that I don't already know about and I'm working on to fix. That was part of the way that I lived. Such pressure.
God.
Wow.
But that's part exhausting. Of it was exhausting, but part of it was that keeps me from the pain of somebody seeing something ugly in me that I'm not already aware of. That was felt much better way to live than to be free and potentially foolish.
Exposed,
right? Mm-hmm. I was my own worst enemy. So right. You can't say anything negative about me because I'm already disdaining myself too much, you know. But I remember walking around the lake in Denver, Colorado, and we were talking, and I don't remember the context, but we were talking about something in my life, and I made the comment to him. I said, you know, I hate the thought of there being something in my life that I don't, that's ugly or that needs to be changed or worked on that I don't know about. I hate the thought of somebody else seeing something in me I don't already see in myself. Mm-hmm. And I thought he would be impressed. And what he said instead was, you know, Daniel, that is one of the most unattractive elements of who you are. And I know exactly what you're talking about, and I've felt it for years. And it took my breath away.
It's rocked your boat.
Wow. Rocked my boat, but began the realization that all of this work I'm doing to be kind of on my A game in all my relationships, really, instead of improving my relationships, are taking away from those that would want to actually love me.
And probably pushing them away.
Pushing them away. It was distasteful. And I thought, wait a minute, how I've been doing, the rut I've been in, how I've been doing life is not working so well.
Yeah.
That would be more of a disruptive moment. Some of the other ones, we don't have time, but the stories, some of literally the most wonderful, beautiful gifts in my life, including the adoption of my daughter, were things that were dropped by God into my lap, not in moments where I was having my quiet time every day and involved in two different Bible studies and abstaining from just, you know, every sin I could think of. There was not a pressured external holiness going on in me that kind of led to God giving me these wonderful gifts. They kind of came, they were gifts. And when I trace back to how did I get God to do this for me? Nothing.
For me, you know, just when I think about letting go of the story I've been writing, I am conflicted. I get this sense of relief that y'all talked about. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I don't have to be perfect. I can just go and you know, and just present who I am. And then there is this overriding at points sense of just terror.
Yeah.
It's like, but what?
That
all
the
what
I was
ifs.
Too. I'm right
but
with you.
Is God's story really good for me?
Oh gosh. Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all the theology I've read about the goodness of God, it's like, but do I really believe it here? Like, is his story really going to be good and pleasing to me? And I'm learning that. I'm learning that it is the best story. And I've done a shoddy job of writing my own story. And that his story is always the best. Carter, Daniel, thank you all so much for joining in the conversation. This was really, really good. And I hope those of you who are out there listening about Landmark Number One can sort of get the feel for what it's like to begin a conversation with other friends about these really, really important issues. And we're going to be doing this again very soon for the second Landmark. Daniel will be with us and then another guest. And that second Landmark is going to be about idols. And I hope you will join us then. Thanks so much for listening in.